Good morning. Wendell made that joke earlier about the sermon going 60 or 70 minutes this morning, but as you all know, my wife is 32 and a half weeks pregnant right now and teaching Sunday school this month, and her last advice, or maybe we'll go with instructions to me, as the children were dismissed, or keep it short. If the Spirit leads you to go long, just ignore it. So, upon those words, you're all dismissed. No, we won't make it quite that short, but I think we'll all be getting out plenty early this morning. Today, we are returning to our series on the Pentateuch after a two-week break, which is like 3-4 months in sermon years. Sermon years are kind of like dog years. You forget the things that you hear here on Sunday mornings about 7 times as fast as you forget things in the rest of your daily lives. At least that's been my experience. So I thought it would be appropriate to start with just a little bit of review. So what is the Pentateuch? And this is not a trick question. Five tukes. Tuke being that a knit hat with a bill on the front, right? So it's the first 5 books of the Bible, right? And it's really easy to find. There are really 2 main strategies you can use. You can either just start at the beginning of your Bible, and it's very difficult to miss. But if you're looking for a slightly more sporting method, what you can do is just flip through and look for the really clean pages. You might find yourself in the Minor Prophets at first, but if you stick with it, eventually you'll find it. Maybe less so for Genesis and Exodus, but I think if we were doing a fantasy football style draft of least read Bible books, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy come off the board pretty quickly. But these books are no less important for being infrequently read. In fact, we think they're very important and relevant to the lives of believers, but in order to really benefit from them, we have to know how to interpret them and understand them correctly. And you all know I'm not a big story guy, but I actually have a story that goes along with this and sort of illustrates this point. For those of you watching online, there was just a collective gasp that went through the auditorium. So when I was out at Summit in 2010, one of the speakers was a scientist, and I can't remember what his PhD was in, but I want to say it was biology. And he spoke on evolution and creation and argued quite strongly for a literal 6-day understanding of the creation account. Now, I leaned toward, and even at that time leaned toward, more of an old earth understanding of the creation account. But given the opportunity to learn more from someone with expertise in a related field, I wanted to find out more from him. So when we had an open forum session, I asked him, was there anything in particular, an argument or a line of evidence that you found very compelling when you were sorting this issue out for yourself? And he answered, and he said, well, it actually didn't have anything to do with science. I just sat down and read the creation account, and I was struck that this just really feels like it was meant to be taken literally. Now, I'm not here this morning to take any position whatsoever on the age of the universe or the manner in which God created it. My concern with this approach has to do with hermeneutics. We're separated from the writing of Genesis by thousands of years with huge differences in language and culture. To simply sit down and read an English translation of the creation account and evaluate it by our initial impressions is to risk significant misinterpretation, because our initial impressions are going to be largely formed by our contemporary 21st century literary standards. We're not the original readers and hearers of the text, and we have to keep that in mind. As Stuart and Fee write in How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth, a text can never mean what it never meant. Rather than evaluating the text solely by our initial impressions, we must try to interpret it in light of how it would have been understood by the original audience. This is not an easy thing to do, which is why we thought it would be beneficial to spend an entire series on the Pentateuch. So this morning, we're actually just going to recap what we've covered so far. I know that's not very exciting, but in return, I promise this is going to be short. I think my dad still holds the record for shortest text sermon ever. I think just over 10 minutes. I'm not entirely certain on that, and we won't be challenging that, but we'll definitely be getting out early. Amen. All right, so we started this series with a discussion of the genres of the Pentateuch. And there are a number of genres represented within the Pentateuch, but we've been focusing on the two main genres, and that is law and narrative. Law is very prominently present throughout the Pentateuch. Law is the typical English translation of the Hebrew word Torah. However, the Hebrew concept of Torah is much broader than what we generally mean by the English word law. What associations come to mind when you hear the word law? Probably formal legal codes produced by governing bodies. We think of things like crime and punishment, courtrooms, hearings, litigation, torts, misdemeanors, all those sorts of things. At least I do. In contrast, the Hebrew word Torah might be better translated instruction or teaching. Peter Vogt describes it as theologically centered instruction in the things necessary for the people of God to know in order to live a good life. The word Torah is used to describe the Pentateuch as a whole. For the ancient Israelites, the entire Pentateuch was Torah inasmuch as it was instruction in how to live a life pleasing to God. This instruction includes legal material but is not reducible to it. We should also note that the law was not the means by which the relationship between Israel and God was established. The Torah is given to the Israelites after God has already rescued them from Egypt and established a relationship with them. Keeping the law is not the means by which the Israelites became God's people. Rather than a burden of legalistic requirements, the Torah is a gift from God to his people, a gift that tells them what they need to know in order to live as his people. We might almost think of the Torah as a prescription for holy living or living in a manner pleasing to God. We also noted some of the difficulties with approaches to the law that seek to organize individual laws into different categories to determine which still apply for us today as Christians. Multiple systems for doing this have been proposed, and they differ somewhat, but they generally divide the law into such categories as civil, ceremonial, and moral. Under these systems, the moral laws are seen as still binding for the Christian, while the other categories are not. However, we don't find these categories anywhere in Scripture, and we don't see any evidence that the original audience would have understood the law in this way. Further, these categories are not as clear-cut as they may seem at first glance, and some laws appear to fall into multiple categories. In light of these difficulties, we have proposed a paradigmatic approach to the law. Rather than categorizing laws in an attempt to determine which apply and which do not, we first seek to understand how the law functioned for Israel in its mission as God's people and witness to the rest of the world. Once we have that understanding in place, we look for ways that that paradigm applies to our situation. As Vogt writes, the question in a paradigmatic approach is not, is the law applicable to the Christian, but rather, how is the law applicable to the Christian? Vogt describes the process thus. When we examine a biblical law, we must first determine what the text meant to the original author and audience. Part of that process involves establishing what the purpose of the law was for ancient Israel, bearing in mind the call of Israel to be a paradigm for holy living and, as such, a witness to the rest of humanity. Then we can articulate a principle that underlies the law. Finally, we can identify ways in which the principle is applicable in other settings. The other major genre of the Pentateuch is narrative. Narratives are records of events, very simply. And one important feature of the biblical narratives that we want to keep in mind is that they are selective as opposed to exhaustive records. Really, all narratives are in some sense selective, but this is very important. Not everything that happened is recorded in the biblical narratives, and even of the events that are recorded, not every detail is included. Narratives have a purpose, and that purpose determines which details are included. For the narratives included in the Pentateuch, that purpose is generally theological. That is, the narratives are intended to tell us something about God and his interaction with the world and with his people. There are many details, interesting details that we would love to have, that are not included because they are not necessary to accomplish the author's communicative purpose. Likewise, we have to remember again that we are not the original audience of the Pentateuch. The author's decisions about which details to include and which not would have been determined in consideration of the original readers and hearers, not us. Their expectations and the details they would have expected and been most interested in are not necessarily the same as those that we might most like to have. We also noted three major themes of the Pentateuch. The first of these is the sovereignty and supremacy of Yahweh. We see this throughout the Pentateuch, starting with the creation account, where God creates everything from nothing by himself. Unlike many other ancient Near Eastern creation accounts, the world is not the product of multiple gods. It is the product of Yahweh and Yahweh alone. I'm not going to take time to retrace this theme throughout all five books of the Pentateuch this morning, but one other example I'll mention is the Exodus. And we're all aware of the story of how God rescues Israel from Egypt, displaying his power in the process and his supremacy over the gods of Egypt. The gods of Egypt, I use that term very loosely. But one detail that might be lost on us today, given our separation in culture, is that Yahweh defeats the Egyptian gods and demonstrates his superiority within the land of Egypt. And in the ancient Near Eastern world, gods were largely believed to be territorial, and their power was in some sense limited to, or at least strongest, in the area where they lived. All the inhabitants of that area were seen as, in some sense, under the dominion of those gods. So for Yahweh to defeat the gods of Egypt on their home field would have been a very significant indication of his supremacy to the original readers and hearers, and for that matter, to the Egyptians. A second major theme that we looked at is the seriousness of sin. This theme first emerges in Genesis when Adam and Eve rebel. The consequences are dramatic: expulsion from the garden and from God's immediate presence, strife in interpersonal relationships, the marring of nature, and of course, eventual death. Following Schaeffer, we might note the four separations that occur: separation of man from God, separation of man from himself, separation of man from man, and separation of man from nature. This theme also shows up powerfully in the flood narrative. As Guy noted several weeks ago, other ancient Near Eastern cultures also had stories of floods brought about by the gods to rid the earth of man. But in these stories, the motivation is that man is being noisy and disturbing the gods' sleep. In contrast, the biblical flood account is quite clear that the flood is a result of human sin. Yahweh is not concerned about lack of sleep. He is concerned with sin and evil in the world. Genesis 6:5 tells us, "The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time." This is the motivation for the flood. Another indicator of the seriousness of sin is the fact that, with the exception of those saved on the ark, all life is destroyed by the flood, not just humans. There are countless other places that the seriousness of sin is apparent in the Pentateuch. We might think of examples like the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, the way God handles the frequent rebellions of his people, and the fact that even Moses is not allowed to enter the promised land because of his actions at Kadesh. But this is probably sufficient for our purposes this morning in doing a brief survey. So let's move to our third major theme, and that is the grace of Yahweh. We see this theme throughout the Pentateuch to a degree that it almost seems silly to offer examples, but we'll briefly look at a few. First, we might note that in response to Adam and Eve's rebellion, God does not destroy mankind and start over, as he would have been entirely justified in doing. And not only that, but in Genesis 3:15, we see the first reference to God's plan to redeem mankind in the cursing of the serpent, when God tells that the woman's offspring will crush the head of the serpent. This is referred to, I gotta make sure I try to pronounce this right, the Proto-Evangelium, I think. The internet was fairly split between Proto-Evangelium and Proto-Evangelium, so I don't know if anyone knows, and if not, then I guess I'm safe either way. But for you nerds out there, this is the compound of the Greek words protos, or first, and euangelion, or gospel. Thus, in God's immediate response to man's rebellion, we get a glimpse of his plan to save us through Christ. Now, on a brief side note, verse 4 of Hark the Herald Angels Sing is a reference to this passage and has long been my favorite Christmas song for this reason. And for those of you that don't remember that verse, I will read it here. I'm not Ben Witherington, so I'm not going to sing it for you, but I'll read it. It goes, "Come, desire of nations, come, fix in us thy humble home. Rise, the woman's conquering seed, bruise in us the serpent's head. Adam's likeness now efface, stamp thine image in its place. Second Adam from above, reinstate us in thy love." Absolutely fantastic words. But back to the Pentateuch. The grace of God is readily apparent throughout the rest of the Pentateuch, from the calling of Abram and the promise to bless the world through his offspring, to God's patience with his people despite their persistent rebellion and rejection of him. But one indicator of God's grace I'd like to highlight that, again, might be a bit less obvious to us today is the giving of the law. This might not immediately strike us as especially gracious. However, when we recall that the function of the law is not to impose arbitrary rules that must be kept in order to earn God's favor, but rather instruction in how to live a life pleasing to God, we see that it is indeed a very gracious thing for God to provide his people with the law rather than leaving them to muddle through and figure out on their own how to please him. Next, we looked at some preliminary aspects of interpretation of the Pentateuch. We touched briefly on Old Testament textual criticism and noted while there are some areas where we may have some questions about which of a number of possible readings is original, fully 90% of the text of the Old Testament is not in question, and the 10% remaining does not alter any of our theological commitments. Stuart Fee writes, "It would not be correct to suggest that the various ancient versions of the Bible are in hopeless disagreement with one another, or that the percentage of textual corruption is so high as to render questionable large blocks of Scripture. Rather, it is fair to say that the verses, chapters, and books of the Bible would read largely the same and would leave the same impression on the reader, even if one adopted virtually every possible alternative reading to those now serving as the basis for current English translations. In fact, absolutely nothing essential to the major doctrines of the Bible would be affected by any responsible decision in the area of textual criticism." We then looked at parallels between the Pentateuch and other ancient Near Eastern literature. And this is significant because the Bible was not written in a vacuum. Rather, the authors of the Old Testament had worldviews, and those worldviews influenced the things that they wrote and the way that their readers and hearers would have understood the things that they wrote. The worldview of the ancient Israelites had much in common with the broader ancient Near Eastern worldview, but it differed and differed significantly in a number of areas. An understanding of other ancient texts help us to understand the unique emphases and perspectives of the Old Testament. Further, the author and audience of the Pentateuch were likely familiar with parallel texts from the surrounding nations and cultures. And in some cases, the author of the Pentateuch may have been intentionally engaging with these texts in order to attack or refute them. So we noted three major tenets of the ancient Near Eastern worldview. First, the gods were very real. Many nations had a primary deity, but they generally recognized the existence of other deities. Second, all of life had religious significance. The ancients did not draw the same distinction that we often draw between sacred and secular. Nothing was outside of or independent from the realm of the religious. Third, corporate identity was paramount. The individual was not nearly as important as the group, and people thought of themselves as members of a family, clan, tribe, and nation. We then noted similarities and differences between the laws in the Pentateuch and other ancient Near Eastern legal codes. Like other ancient Near Eastern legal codes, say that five times fast, the biblical laws are designed to foster the well-being of society, and there is stress on social justice throughout. However, unlike the biblical laws, the laws of other ancient Near Eastern cultures were not grounded in the character and morality of the gods. In other legal codes, what is allowed or forbidden is not determined by right and wrong per se, but rather by what promotes social order. And this leads to significant differences in the content of the laws. For instance, the Code of Hammurabi distinguishes between people of various social classes and provides for different punishments depending on the social status of the victim. In contrast, the biblical laws do not prescribe different punishments based on the status of the victim. As another example, the Middle Assyrian laws allow for commutation of punishment by human authorities, right, or human victims. For instance, if a man's wife committed adultery and she was found guilty by the judges, the man could choose to have his wife and her lover released without punishment. In contrast, there is no such provision in the biblical laws. Because God is ultimately the offended party, human victims do not have the authority to commute punishment. There are also similarities between narrative texts from ancient Near Eastern cultures and the narrative texts in the Pentateuch. Texts such as Atrahasis, the Enuma Elish, and the Gilgamesh epic contain creation or flood accounts, or both, that have some similarities to the creation and flood accounts recorded in Genesis. However, the biblical accounts differ significantly from the accounts of other ancient Near Eastern cultures. In Atrahasis, mankind was created to relieve the lesser gods of the tedious work of digging canals. However, as human beings became numerous, their noise disturbs the sleep of the gods, so the gods send a flood to destroy humanity. In the Enuma Elish, the earth is formed from the body of a slain god. In the Gilgamesh epic, the gods are terrified by the flood that they send to destroy mankind. There are plenty of other differences that could be listed, but again, my point this morning is not to give an exhaustive catalog. My point is that the differences between these accounts and the biblical text are striking, and the differences tell us important things about how the worldview of the Israelites differed from the views of the surrounding nations and cultures. After this, we looked briefly at the documentary hypothesis. The documentary hypothesis rose to prominence in the mid to late 18th century, and it holds that the Pentateuch was not written by Moses, was actually compiled over time from four different sources, which are labeled J, E, D, and P. Evidence cited for this includes the different names used for God in the Pentateuch and the presence of doublets, or stories that are so similar that they almost seem to be different versions of the same story. Examples of this include the dual accounts of Abraham presenting his wife as his sister, and the repeated accounts of a patriarch or his representative meeting a bride at a well. Now, for all its ingenuity, the documentary hypothesis does not enjoy nearly the support that it once did among scholars. And we also noted that the Bible repeatedly affirms Moses as the author of the Pentateuch. And we're actually going to return to the documentary hypothesis in a couple minutes, so we're going to let that suffice for now. So finally, in light of all this material, we looked at some steps, or perhaps we should say they're actually more guidelines for understanding and applying Old Testament laws. First, we should determine how the passage develops or reinforces God's purpose for the original readers. As we've noted throughout, Israel was to serve as God's witness to the surrounding nations, and the law was an instrumental piece of this process. When we read a passage, whether narrative or law, we should be asking how that passage fits into God's purpose for Israel. Second, we want to determine the type of law we are dealing with. There are various kinds of laws in the Pentateuch, including criminal laws, case laws, family laws, sacrificial laws, symbolic laws, sacred calendar laws, and compassion laws. Determining the type of law we are dealing with will help us to determine how the law applies to us today. Third, we want to determine what the law's purpose was for Israel. This involves asking questions like, why was the law given? What objective is it seeking to accomplish? What kind of situation was this law designed to prevent or promote? What value or moral principles are behind it? What vision of society is being promoted? Is there a penalty for breaking the law? What does the penalty tell us about the seriousness of the law? Once we've answered the above questions, we are ready for step four, which is determine how to apply the law's purpose in a Christian context. The objective is to determine how the purpose of the law can be preserved for us despite our vastly different situation. All right, so that concludes our brief summary of what we've covered so far in this series. But before we end, I'd like to return to the documentary hypothesis for just a moment. A few years ago, Silas McAulfer sent me a satirical article entitled New Directions in Poo Studies by David J.A. Clines, who is a biblical scholar and emeritus professor at the University of Sheffield. In the article, Klein analyzes the corpus of poo literature and concludes that it could not possibly have been written by A.A. Milne. Rather, Klein determines that behind the poo literature, there are actually four different sources, which he designates J, E, D, and P. Sound familiar? As evidence for this, among other things, he cites the multiple names used for poo. Poo is referred to as poo, Winnie the Pooh, bear, poo bear, and so on. Further, we also observe doublets within the poo literature. For instance, we have two accounts of meeting a heffalump, and we have two accounts of building a house. So after settling the question of authorship, Klein analyzes the mythology of the Pooh literature and concludes that Pooh is a devotee of the goddess Honey, who is a consort to Christopher Robin, who is, of course, a dying and rising vegetation god. The article is extremely clever, and I think it serves as a humorous illustration of the excesses to which skeptical scholarship can run when given a full head of steam and creative license. I wanted to share some excerpts from the article this morning, but I ultimately decided pulling out parts would destroy the humor. So instead, I will post a link to the article in the Unofficial Tech Facebook group when I get home today, so any of you who are interested can peruse it at your leisure. All right, so that's it for our material this morning. We may not have broken the record for shortest tech sermon ever, but I'm pretty confident this is the first sermon here that has ever concluded with a discussion of Winnie the Pooh, so at least we have that. So next week, we're going to talk briefly about some guidelines for interpreting narrative, and then we are going to look at a few examples of law and narrative passages and work through how we apply what we've learned to understand actual passages from the Pentateuch.